You are listening to Thought Thief by K.E. Preston. Chapter 24, Wren. Elliot and Zithril were happy enough to keep each other entertained in the maze until Wren could change back into her trousers and vest, grab her things, and make herself scarce. Still, she felt an urgency to dress quickly and leave quietly. She was happy for Zithril. She had made a friend during her short time in Altair, and that friend was in love with someone who loved him back fiercely. Wren had had her doubts before speaking with Elliot. Zithril struck her as the kind of man who could fall in love with a story of a romance and then defend that story to the bitter end, even if the person was unworthy. But Elliot loved his prince. He loved Zithril in a protective and sensible way that made her hopeful for the two men's future. They worked together. They could be happy together. A shard of guilt pierced her heart. They could not be happy together. Not as long as they stayed here, under Fergie's rule. She was leaving them. Zithril was her friend. She very well could have been his last hope. And in his hour of need, she was abandoning him like the coward she was. No, Wren told herself forcefully, as she checked her pack's contents one last time and then hoisted it onto her shoulders. No, she was not abandoning him. She had offered them both a way out, and Zithril had chosen to stay. She had a family who needed her back in White Silver. She was not going to leave Rita and the children just because this prince was determined to save a kingdom that did not want saving. Maybe Elliot would talk sense into him. Maybe she would walk into the ship's wreck one day, and there would be a letter from Altair telling her that they were ready to leave. Maybe, Wren hoped, as she glanced over her shoulder at the neat, empty room before stepping through the servant's door and into the tunnels. She zipped through the hallways, switching back, forth, and around as she followed the thin vein of power, focused and intent on her destination. The door glowed unwavering in her mind, and after her conversation with Zithril and the events of the tea party that afternoon, Wren knew with certainty where that door led. She just had to get there. She turned the last corner and began to race down the long hall to the door, and then drew to a stop. Travok leaned against the wall, arms crossed, eyes glaring.
I knew it,
he scoffed.
What are you doing here?
She hissed, head swiveling this way and that.
I asked myself, what would be the most dangerous thing Wren could do? But then, of course, you and the prince snuck outside for a little rendezvous, and I thought, I'm not sure why they are bothering, seeing as how what they are about to do in private is only marginally less appropriate than what they are basically doing in public. But at least she is not going to do anything that would blow us all to smithereens.
You were keeping a close eye on my whereabouts tonight, Wren said, folding her arms and jutting out a hip as Travok continued with his lecture.
But then I saw you sneak back inside, and I thought, of course you were just leading the prince on as a distraction. Of course you would come back here. Of course this is what you meant by making inquiries.
Are you quite finished?
Wren said through gritted teeth, eyes again checking their surroundings.
And if you are not finished, would you mind keeping your voice down?
Travok did not keep his voice down.
You cannot be serious,
he went on.
Wren, you should not and cannot tamper with this ward. The amount of power pouring into this thing could destroy the palace, possibly all of Altair. You would kill thousands.
Do you really think all of that power is going towards a single, simple security measure?
Wren asked, stopping the wizard's tirade in its tracks.
Or,
she went on,
is it much more likely that all this power, all this energy, is going to the ward and something hidden behind this door?
They both looked at each other for a long moment, Wren raising her eyebrows, Travok pursing his lips.
You have no way of being certain of that,
he finally said, chewing the inside of his cheek. Wren rolled her eyes and grabbed Travok by the hand, leading him to one of the symbols carved into the side of the doorway
and pushing his fingers into the wall next to it, holding them there so he could not pull away. "Feel that?" she asked. "Feel the hum coming from that mark? This ward has 3 marks, mind, body, and spirit, the Athrashi triad. Each of those marks is receiving an equal amount of power. Now, if you take what you are feeling right now and multiply it by 3, is that the amount of power you were expecting to feel? Or is it somewhat lacking?"
"You know an awful lot about wards for a maid or a merchant's daughter or whatever you are supposed to be today."
He was right. She hated that she was showing her hand again, hated that this man had somehow gathered enough of her carelessly dropped pieces to know her a little better. Still, what choice did she have? She needed in this door, and Trevok was not going away. Trevok pulled his hand away, stepping back, flexing his fingers. Rin suddenly realized how close they had been standing, hand to hand, practically cheek to cheek. She leaned against the wall and considered the man whose presence she had not even noticed until it was no longer there. He squinted his eyes and stroked his beard and thought, a little divot appearing just above his nose as he did. Earlier that evening, Trevok had seemed strained, stretched thin, as if 2 people were trying to wear the same face. The look fit him as poorly as his orange suit. This look, however, the one of contemplation and weighing of facts, this look sat quite well on his features. She liked it. Liked watching the gears of his mind work. It was amusing, or comforting, or some other feeling she could not quite name. Trevok looked up, and Rin was almost embarrassed to be caught staring. Almost.
"You changed your clothes,"
he muttered with a quick up-and-down flick of his eyes. "Sneaking around in a ball gown is impractical. You, I see, went a different direction," Rin answered, eyeing the obnoxious orange suit.
"And the paint,"
he said, gesturing at her eyes.
"You kept that. Does that help with the sneaking?"
"Trevok, do you want inside this door or not?" Rin asked, impatient with the conversation that was going nowhere, and well aware of the time they were wasting. Trevok sighed and leaned back against the opposite wall.
"It does not matter what I want. Unless you have a pickaxe in your bag, we are not breaking that ward."
He ran a hand over his face and then blinked back up at her.
"You don't have a pickaxe in there, do you?"
"Oh, Trevok," Rin smiled, pushing away from the wall. "You really can tell the kind of training a wizard has received by the types of problems they cannot solve."
"What is that supposed to mean?"
Trevok growled. "You see," she said, setting down her pack and fishing in her pocket to pull out the chalk, "we do not have to break this ward or these symbols. What we have to do is contain the power and work very, very fast." Rin turned to face the door, rolling her neck and popping her wrists. Then she let out 1 long breath and ran. "First, we isolate," she hissed, sprinting to draw a ring around the first mark, then the second, before kicking off the doorframe, launching herself into the air, and drawing a 3rd circle around the top mark. "Next, we redirect," Rin grunted, as the energy of the marks began to gnaw on the flimsy borders now containing them, filling the air with a smell of burning dust. As she fell from the ceiling, she dragged her chalk down, connecting the top ring with the center of the door. In a blink, she drew the final circle at the bottom of the new line and then hurriedly connected the other 2 circles. Light rushed out of the rings, down the chalk, to the center of the door, like water flowing through a trough. "Last, we repurpose." Quickly, she drew her own symbol for door, a mark that would not be repeated by anyone in any language. Then she nicked her palm with the knife at her belt, pressed her blood into her own marking, and infused the glyph with her will and the image of the door standing before her. Rin stared at the glowing rings and lines she had just drawn, taking a moment to catch her breath. She was out of practice with things like this. Still, the whole working had taken her less than 10 seconds to complete, which was not bad. "Would you like to do the honors?" she asked Trebok, who was glaring at her work with a look that said he would not be impressed.
"It cannot be that simple,"
he grumbled, folding his arms. Rin's hands were shaking with leftover anxiety and precision. Sweat was starting to glisten on her upper lip, and she wanted to scream at this man. She would like to see him sprint to complete this spell and call it easy. But instead, she said, "Perhaps it should not be that complicated." She opened the door with a little bow, hand traveling through its slightly wavering copy. Rin smiled in satisfaction, ducking under the glowing lines of the chalk that hung suspended in the air through the ghostly shadow of the door. "Do not smudge the chalk," she called over her shoulder as she entered the vast room beyond. Rin looked at the familiar, echoing salon she had been marched through earlier that day.
"Where are we?"
Trebok whispered at her shoulder, the question bouncing around the dark space.
"The Thrill's chambers," Rin answered. "I noticed at the tea party today that there were not any of those large mirrors that covered the servants' doors, just the door behind us that appeared to lead to nowhere."
"Only two plainly visible points of entry,"
Trebok nodded to himself.
"Someone is security conscious."
Rin squatted down and drew a circle around the two of them, followed by a large triangle.
"What are you doing?"
Trebok hissed.
"Taking care of any lingering staff,"
she replied, sketching out her symbol for sleep.
"Wait,"
Trebok insisted, stopping her movements with a hand on her shoulder.
"No one is here."
Rin stopped and got to her feet, listening to the silence. A quiet house had a different sound than an empty one. It was always easy to tell when no one was home. Still, Rin had to be sure. Quickly, she dropped back to her knees, erasing her first mark and replacing it with the one for person. Again, she squeezed blood from her palm and pressed it with her intent into the floor. An invisible wave went out from her, rippling over the ground, seeping under doors, searching for any heartbeat in the apartment. There was no one. They were alone, and the silence was complete.
"There should be people here,"
Trebok said.
"Attendants."
Rin nodded. "Did you see any other servants in the hall as you waited for me?"
"No,"
he whispered. A chill raced up Rin's back. It was wrong that the room was empty. The room felt wrong. Magic was nothing more than a tool. The rest of the world might assume that certain practices were inherently wicked, but Rin understood that magic could no more be evil than a paintbrush could be good. Even so, Rita's words filled her ears.
"Actions leave a stain, and walls have memories."
Evil had been done here, and it had been done repeatedly, engraving itself into the wood banisters and sealing itself into the marble. She yanked her hand back, shaking it like she had just touched a pan fresh from the fire.
"We are wasting time,"
Rin said, stepping out of the circle and turning to face the grand double stairs. Rin liked to believe she was above things like gut instinct or hunches. Still, she knew where she was supposed to go, and she was not going to waste time denying it. As they silently ascended the large staircase that led to Lithril's bedroom, Rin could not ignore the tug at her center, the whisper of fate in her ear, the press of fierce hands on her shoulders. She needed to reach out and touch the monster. There were no wards on Lithril's door, no locks to pick, no one was lying in wait, just bookshelves and a bed, a desk and a rug. Even so, Trebok and Rin both froze on the doorstep, cautiously peering into the room beyond.
"It's just a room,"
Rin scoffed, shaking herself forward, Trebok close behind. It was clear that Lithril did not let her staff in this room. It was not complete chaos, but the room was only ordered to the point of convenience. The bed was unmade. The papers on the desk were stacked into three untidy piles, the bookshelves undusted. It was easy to see which volumes were regularly taken out and handled.
"What exactly are we looking for?"
Trebok asked, as Ren's fingers moved over the spines of the books. Her hand stopped
on the worn leather cover of a journal, its red binding turning violet in the gloom. She lifted it from the shelf, and her heart nearly fell out of her body as she heard the soft, hidden click of a trigger releasing. Neither of them moved. Neither of them breathed. They were dead, or caught, or both. But a half second later, Trevock let out a whooshing breath of relief as a hidden drawer in the side of the desk slid open. Rin brought the journal over to the desk as Trevock began to pull out papers.
"Have me sideways and toss me into the unknowable void,"
he swore. Rin looked over his shoulder and sucked in a breath. Rin was a talented practitioner, a thought thief with a slightly larger bag of tricks than most. Still, she was no wizard, and she knew when something was beyond her. They looked at the papers on the desk, at the large circles, interconnected triangles, and writing scratched along their edges.
"I've never seen a working of this size,"
Trevock said. "What is it for?" Rin asked, leaning forward. There was something familiar about the markings around the circle.
"I can only guess,"
Trevock admitted.
"See here, here, and here."
He pointed to the small circles at the points of the larger triangle.
"These are three separate spells, meant to create power and then channel that power to the center here, much like your trick with the door,"
he said, moving his finger along the paper to the large circle at its center.
"Once there, that energy would channel to a larger spell through something called a balance, which would then redirect that power towards whatever purpose this working is trying to achieve. Beyond that, I cannot tell you anything. All the specifics are written around the edges here, and I have no idea what language this is written in."
Rin continued to squint at the paper. She knew this writing, knew this alphabet, but it was wrong, like a picture tipped upside down. "It's a code," she said almost to herself. Then, without fully knowing why, she opened the book in her hand and gasped as the picture tilted right way up. "It's Dimirashi," she breathed, a language few Dimmicks even remembered, and almost no one spoke.
"This cannot be Dimirashi. Dimirashi and Itharashi share the same alphabet. I would at least be able to recognize the letters."
"No," Rin corrected. "It is ancient Dimirashi. Ancient Dimirashi is a completely different language."
"And you can read this completely different language,"
Trevock accused, the tone of his voice making Rin's chest go tight and start to itch. She swallowed. "I can, but I cannot read this. It must still be in code. These words do not mean anything. They are not even words. They..." She stopped, struck by the sudden memory of Trevok's smug smile as he lectured her in the hallway. "It's Elvish. Like the lights in the hall, she's writing in Elvish using the ancient Dimirashi alphabet." She threw down the journal, snatched up a quill and loose piece of paper, the steady drumming beat in her chest urging her forward as the gears of the puzzle started to come together. "If I give you the alphabet, can you translate?" Rin asked, hand cramping from the speed of her writing.
"You know the language. It would go faster if we worked together,"
Trevok countered. "Yes, but I have to read that," she said, pausing to nod at the journal.
"And what is that?"
he asked, turning the pages, raising his brow at the strange writing. "My guess? Documentation of Lithrail's descent into madness."
"This does not make sense,"
Trevok said, shaking his head.
"Why use the same language with both of these, but only uncode the spellwork?"
"Your guess is as good as mine. Here," Rin said, thrusting the paper at him and turning to her book. She thumbed a few pages, looking at tables and dates that went back decades. Four bookmarks stuck out of the back of the diary, dividing the last half of the book into sections. Rin turned to the first tab and read Lithril's house at the top of the page. A list of maids, guards, and other staff covered dozens of pages, and next to each name was a number and a series of notes. Twice daily with Formula 12 was accompanied by Retains Ability to Resist or Lost Name Recognition on Above Date, and finally, Achieved Complete Mental Annihilation on Single Dose of Formula 28. Her hands went cold and her mouth went dry as she peeled through the pages looking for today's date. And there she was, her name on a table next to Serafina and Brenora. Formula 2. Serafina, Ethric. None. Assume mental resistance. Double the dose given to human subject. Formula 2. Brenora, Dorf. None. No information gathered. Formula 2. Ren, human. 2 doses. Gained resistance after 3 minutes. Stronger formula required.
God surround me,
Ren wheezed as she reached with shaking hands for the tab marked Zithril's house. Her fingers flew down the page till she found Marcite's name. Failed to dose, failed to convert, was written there, and Ren almost sobbed in relief.
What? What is it?
Trevok snapped. She's been systematically experimenting with the poison she used on me today for decades. By the looks of it, she has complete mental control over most of the palace staff.
What?
Trevok said in a whispered shout, reaching for the diary, but Ren waved him away. Get back to work. I will show you when you are done, she reassured him as she flipped to the final tab. Here the tables and lists stopped, and the recordings of thoughts and personal histories began.
7th day of Samea, 5029. Maker and Walker were right. Mother's death has left me with more options than I could have hoped. They both continue to stay in contact and show me how I can best serve.
Ren checked the date again. Trevok, what was the cause of the Queen of Altair's death again?
Not sure. Why?
He asked, already absorbed in his work.
Oh, no reason,
Ren sang, as she grimaced and flipped to a random date.
3rd day of winter, 5101. Maker continues to insist that the working is not complete. Worse still, Walker has lost the key. Maker and Walker are both continuing to insist that I do nothing but expend rift. How have we worked together for so long, and they still treat me like a child? I am trying not to lose hope, but this was the cause that gave me power when I had none, and now I am powerless to save it. 24th day of spring, 5108. I have found a replacement for the key and mended the lock. Neither of them can deny me now. Maker is as approving as always, but Walker is beside himself with jealousy. He keeps insisting that he will find a balance for the working, but he is always so full of talk. I cannot decide if I want him to be lying so he will fall on his face, or if I want him to be telling the truth so this chapter will be over and I can receive the reward owed me.
The puzzle was almost complete. Ren could now see enough of the picture to guess what she would find. Still, she turned to the date of her arrival in Altair and skimmed the last few lines jotted there.
10th day of Samael, 5109. The balance is here ahead of schedule. Maker has arrived, but Walker is still days away. I have sent word to him to hasten his arrival. 20th day of Samael, 5109. Still no sign of Walker. That man loves to take time we do not have. I am concerned that I might have overshot when trying to determine the correct dosage to subdue the balance. I am sure they will leave tonight. Maker seems content to be silent and wait, but I feel like we need to move now. I have sent word to Walker, of course, but it might be time to take matters into my own hands.
Ren gently closed the journal and looked around the room. Judging by the emptiness of Lithril's chamber, time was running out. She felt her mind start to move, making connections and jumping to conclusions faster than her body could process. Her heart was beating like thunder, sending jolts of power through her limbs, freezing her to the spot, causing her hands to tremble.
Breathe,
she whispered to herself, looking around the room of a madwoman.
Just breathe.
Ren pushed her focus to her breath, counting the inhales and exhales before beginning to tally up what she knew. The princess and her two accomplices had been widening the rift for years, and now they were planning something else, something bigger. For almost 100 years, they had been acquiring locks and keys, most likely working on the spell Trevok was rushing to translate. And judging by the last date in Lethril's diary, she was putting their plan into motion tonight.
Breathe, she repeated to herself, glancing out the window at the rift, pulsing purple in the night.
This woman was dangerous. Rin had always known that. But dangerous without a direction was one thing. Dangerous with a goal was something else entirely. The excitement of the mystery was fading, and the dread was coming back.
Got it, Trevok cried out with a triumphant little twirl of his quill. Good, Rin said, snatching the papers out from under his nose, thrusting them and the journal into her bag. We are leaving.
Chapter 25. Seraphina. Light was all Seraphina knew. There was nothing in her mind but little shining luminescent diamonds twirling before her eyes. Next came the soft tinkling of glass, and the diamonds formed themselves into crystals. A chandelier? She silently asked herself as she moved forward for a better look, walking into something hard and cold.
A mirror? She said, reaching hands forward to brush the polished surface and stare at her reflection.
But the reflection was wrong, or not wrong so much as old. The face that stared back at Seraphina had once belonged to her, but had since been washed away by the hands of fate. Her formerly honey-blonde hair framed a sun-bronzed face and copper-brown eyes that she had once shared with her mother. The dress she wore was strange as well, white and glistening like frost on a windowpane, with skirts full enough to hide a brood of children beneath. The corset was tight, and the neckline was low. It was a dress she would have worn before. She brushed gentle fingers across the smooth, perfect skin of her chest.
I must be dreaming,
Seraphina whispered to herself. The musical notes of laughter floated through the air, drawing her attention away from the mirror. As she turned, her thoughts melted from her mind, and she became transfixed by the sight before her. It was a ballroom unlike any she had ever seen. Dark stone archways grew from the floor that moved and rippled like water with every step she took. The night sky stretched above her, and stars floated past her eyes close enough to touch. Cobwebs of lace grew from the walls and draped themselves over chandeliers, and everything moved and spun in time to the music that danced around her. The room was stuffed full of bodies. Waves of fabric twirled as their owners drank and laughed. They moved like the ocean, in one large rippling mass pulled and directed by an unseen hand. The sea parted for Seraphina as she moved this way and that, the dancers sensing where she needed to go and clearing a path. She was looking for someone, she thought to herself, as she floated through the ballroom, peering over shoulders and looking around skirts. She was supposed to be meeting someone, or maybe she had left them waiting somewhere? Mindlessly, she lifted up one of the tablecloths. Two nearly identical faces blinked back at her, a young raven-haired girl and a golden-haired boy whose face reminded Seraphina of sunshine.
Oh, hello there. Can you help me? She asked.
The little girl hissed at Seraphina, teeth snapping at her fingers.
Lethril,
the boy chided in Elvish. Don't be rude. Seraphina had just enough time to wonder if she had always spoken Elvish before the children dashed out around her ankles.
Come, Lethril, she'll ruin it,
the girl said, grabbing the boy by the hand and disappearing into the crowd.
Wait, Seraphina cried out. Wait, can you tell me where I am?
But it was no use. The once calm and yielding sea now fought against her, the people pushing her back and spinning faster than her eyes could track as the children's laughter bounced around the room.
She tried to duck and weave, but the wall of dancers was now herding her away, forcing her down paths she did not choose for herself. The harder she fought, the firmer the resistance, and at last she was shoved back, tripping over the hem of her dress and landing backwards on the floor.
"Well, you were not who I was expecting,"
drawled a voice from somewhere above her. Seraphina turned to see a man dressed in red, idly holding a cane and staring at her like she was a piece of fruit being weighed and measured by the grocer.
"Though perhaps you are a worthy consolation prize," he said at last, extending a hand to help her to her feet.
His fingers were long and slender, his nails so pointed that they might as well have been claws. His skin was a deep, garnet brown that faded into a true red in the strange, fluctuating light. His suit was also red, and decorated with the most intricate black embroidery Seraphina had ever seen. The symbols twisted and turned over the garment, forming round circles one moment and sharp triangles the next. The jacket hung on an almost gaunt frame, which strangely, on him, did not look unhealthy. This man was made to wear the sharp angles on his face and the slender bones in his wrist. Even his slightly large and pointed nose did not feel unattractive. Instead, it matched his pointed beard and his slick black hair. As soon as she was on her feet, the stranger tossed his cane to the floor and pulled her into a dancer's embrace. A waltz began, and Seraphina felt the man's hands pull her along to the music, effortlessly guiding and directing her without the hesitancy of asking for permission.
"I'm looking for someone," she stated, looking over the man's shoulder as they turned around the ballroom.
"Well, you will not find them here,"
the man said, taking her chin in his hand and turning her face this way and that as they somehow kept pace with the dancers.
"Stupid girl. Not you. My friend. She has gone and given you too much. It is a wonder your minds are only mixing right now, instead of your brain spilling all over that dirty floor of hers."
"I... what?"
"Oh, do not worry. It will all make sense once you wake up."
"I'm dreaming,"
Seraphina said, struggling to keep hold of her train of thought.
"I knew I was dreaming."
The man let out a derisive scoff.
"Definitely not who I was hoping for. Though, I suppose you are better in many ways."
There was something about the growl of his voice that was all too familiar to Seraphina, something that made it clear she was in danger. She didn't dare look in his eyes. She did not want to see the hunger in that starving face. If this was real life, she would have simply yanked her hands out of his and left him standing on the dance floor. But this was not real life, so her body stayed trapped in a dance she had never agreed to, as her mind screamed for her to run.
"I used to collect things like you. Beautiful little things. Of course, your people could never be perfect. But oh, how your bodies try. The mortal form will never have the capabilities to adapt to the exact specifications of the moment. But over time, thousands upon millions of years, all your bodies change to fit the environment around you, the role you were meant for. What role were you destined for before you rejected it out of a fit of rebellion?"
I don't know what you're talking about,"
Seraphina stammered, breaths coming in panicked little gasps that she prayed wouldn't turn into sobs. Why wouldn't her body listen to her? Why couldn't she move?
"Oh, yes. You would have been just the kind of pretty thing I would have loved to have in my collection before I got distracted by harebrained theories and the average. I will never forgive myself for that. And neither will anyone else."
The last part of his sentence turned into a dangerous sneer, and Seraphina felt his hands tighten around her in anger. But then he shook himself and said,
"Oh, well, that is the way of it, I suppose."
"Please," Seraphina tried,
fighting to steady her voice. I need to find my friend. They'll be looking for me.
I told you, they are not here,
the man replied, as they continued to twirl around the room, colors and faces blurring together.
No, I'm supposed to meet them.
What is your friend's name, Can you tell me what they look like?
Seraphina
started, but she couldn't. She could barely remember her own name or that there was life outside of this maddening ballroom. The voices and music spun around them, melding into one wordless sound as Seraphina's feet continued to resist her commands. She looked up to find the man studying her, looking down on her with bottomless, appraising eyes.
It is amazing how close you have actually come to perfection, and yet you do not accept it.
What do you mean?
Seraphina asked, and almost let out a cry of joy when she at last felt her fingers flex against his palm. The man laughed and dropped her hand to gesture at her body.
You have tasted perfection. It flows in your veins, and yet in your mind and in your heart, you choose this form.
He reached forward and placed his hand on her chest, fingers splayed across her sternum.
Why not be who you were meant to be?
Her skin creased and bubbled, changing around his fingers, puckering and scarring as a familiar shade of green crept over her chest.
Stop it!
She yelled, at last breaking free and stumbling backwards out of his grip. Her voice rang around them in the now empty hall as she watched the green fade back to a healthy gold. Seraphina turned in a slow circle, staring down the long row of dark arches.
What's happening? She asked. Weren't we just... Where are we?
Oh, you are waking up, he replied in a bored whine as the children from before ran down the hall behind him.
Seraphina followed them with her eyes as they skipped and danced together, eventually fading from existence, their still laughing voices the only proof that they had ever been. There was a light at the end of the hall, Seraphina realized, and with that light came a wind that sparked with power. Her heart surged with hope as she started towards the light.
When you see my friend, please tell her I'm coming as fast as I can. But I make no promises to be there on time. She is the one who keeps moving up the timetable after all, so she can get herself out of the mess she has gotten herself into,
said the man to Seraphina's back. She turned to ask him who he was talking about, but he was already gone. The hall was empty except for the light and the breeze that was beckoning her forward.
You've been listening to Thought Thief by K.E. Preston, narrated by K.E. Preston. Thought Thief is also available in paperback and ebook at kepreston.net. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, please consider leaving us a review or even sharing this with a friend. If you've really enjoyed what you've heard, there is bonus content available on our Patreon. Every dollar there allows me and my family to keep doing what we love, which is sharing this story with you. Thought Thief is recorded and edited by me, K.E. Preston, with editing help from Hanson Lyman and Mark Gardner. Thought Thief is a work of fiction written by K.E. Preston, with developmental editing and linguistics help by Amanda Berry. Thought Thief is a Lit Lab production. Thank you for listening.